Hi, I'm Justine.
And I'm Sarah Lavon.
And we are so glad you're here.
We believe that your life has the potential to make a deep, meaningful impact on the world around you. You, as a nurse, have the ability to add value to every single person and patient you touch.
We want to inspire you with resources, education, and stories to support you to live your absolute best life, both in and outside of work.
But don't expect perfection over here. We're just here to have some conversations about anything birth, work, and life, trying to add some happy to your hour as we all grow together.
By nurses, for nurses, this is Happy Hour with Bundle Birth Nurses.
I think this might be our first like full series we're wrapping up here. I don't know if we've done a three-part series yet.
No, not that I'm aware of.
I'm so proud of us. It just took three seasons.
We're so creative.
So to catch you up, if you haven't listened to our other two episodes, we started with triage episode one of like how to set your patient up. Triage episode two, we did normal labor, rule out labor, which is ideally the best and easiest. And today we're going to try to downregulate your nervous system on what to do when you have an emergency. Because honestly, when Sarah and I talk about it, we're just like, it's fine. It's not a big deal. And so it is a big deal in a lot of ways. Yes. So I want to say that it's a big deal. But if you just know the steps and know what to do, you can like just be okay about it.
Yep. Well, and I think there's an element of taking on emergencies like, oh my gosh, it's my fault. Or if you somehow internalize or personalize the emergency, then it becomes so much harder. Whereas like, okay, this is what I'm being presented with. And what do I need to do next? I say all the time, even in business, that I think one of our superpowers as nurses is the skill of prioritization. And now my prioritization isn't like, how do I keep a patient alive? Instead, it's like, how do I accomplish 6,000 things all at the exact same time? But like, if people are having a hard time prioritizing, they'll bring me their list. I'm like, I can see very clearly where to go next. So that really is the skill of triage. It's prioritizing the number of patients that you see, who needs to go first. We talked about that in episode one with MIFTI. And then in this case, it's what skills, what next steps do I need to accomplish to get this patient stabilized and ultimately admitted? Whether you take them or not as the patient, that's another episode for another day. But it's really getting them to a place where they are safe, obviously, and or hand it off to the next person.
Yeah, because that's one nice thing about triage. It's like, okay, well, bye.
Exactly.
Go.
Like wrap them up.
So the first one we want to talk about, because honestly, this class could take hours and there are triage classes out there and maybe one day we'll have our own triage class.
I love that this just became a class we're teaching. No pressure.
Oh, here we go. No, but this could be an hour-long class. And this is just, we're trying to do this in a podcast episode on your commute to work. So we're not going to talk all things and all emergencies, but some of the things we brainstormed was number one on like, it's such a pain point and a panic inducer, especially in DMs, especially with new nurses, is what if they come to the back or come to triage or come to the room and they're complete? What am I going to do?
Step this one. This is our favorite one.
It is.
Step
it
one,
is our
panic. It's their term. Two, like, all right, fun.
What is their gestational age? That's going to be
most
the biggest
definitely
thing to think about. And if you have a patient that is term, 37 weeks or up, it's like, great, let's have a baby.
Yep.
And so that one is more listened to the other episode of normal rule out labor, right? Get an IV, get things rolling.
You don't even need an IV.
That's very true.
Yeah. Just put some gloves on, call the team, wheel them to a room, and you have gloves on. If the baby comes out, it comes out. Help them breathe. Say, we got you. Everyone's, as long as you've alerted the team for an imminent birth and it's term, put gloves on. You'll be shaking in your boots when your hands are sweaty and you're like, I can't get that stupid glove.
And if you can't get the glove on, it's also not the end of the world. Just wash your hands after. So yeah, just be there. Don't let the baby fall on the ground.
For you don't know their history. And I'm like, HIV, some sort of contagious.
I've caught a lot of bare-handed babies.
You have not.
Yeah. Probably like 15.
I have never. All the ones I've caught have been with gloves. It might be like a half glove effort in some
I got a glove on my fingers. Yeah. I think too, it was like, as a charge nurse, like I'm just rolling into the room, have no, I think it's different if you're ready, you know, they're complete, I'm keeping my gloves on or like, I don't know. I just, so if they aren't term, that's where it gets a little stickier. And I understand the initial panic. So knowing who to call and knowing who to get on board. So if you have a NICU team, if you have a special care nursery, if you have a peds, if you have
NPs there, your charge, going up your chain, just knowing how to get a hold of people can like relieve so much of the stress. And I think too, with like travel nurses, that's like one of the first thing I would do, I think, as a traveler would be like, how do I get a hold of people? How do I get people to my room? What do I have to pull or push or yell to get people down here? So that could really
and
help.
Or the charge.
Yeah.
If I'm in triage and the patient's 35 and six, I've called the doctor, then they're like huffing and puffing in pain. I feel pushy. They're like, checker. And again, it's like, do you check a preterm-er? Depending on your facility, sometimes they may say hands off. In my facilities, I would. And you're like, oh my God, the baby's right here. That's a charge nurse call. I have a 35-weeker that's, in this case, let's say 28-weeker, even worse, right? A 28-weeker that's complete, heads in the vagina. I need everyone. Then you would expect the charge nurse to call everyone. And in that case, it's like, for me, we're not so much worried about the patient. We're worried about the baby for a preterm birth like that. As long as the patient's stable and they're not bleeding or something, which is the next one we'll talk about. But then it's like, I need NICU team present because if this baby comes out, I want all of the tools and supplies for a preterm baby. So then it's like, that's when you need them in a room for a warmer. Do they need an IV? Probably not. Is that top priority always? I think we think it is, but in the case of a normal spontaneous vaginal birth, you can be okay. The key here for a preterm, I would say, is getting the baby the support that they will need when they are born.
And something Sarah and I mentioned before this call, I initially was like, you need a warmer in the back, of my triage.
In triage?
You should have a warmer in triage. And she's like, well, you can just do skin to skin. And I was like, oh, that's so true. But our triage is pachy triage. So that's why we have a warmer. So it's just like already convenient. But for preterms, that would be nice to know. Do you have abilities? What warmer would you choose if you had a 26-weeker and you wanted to get your resuscitation right away? How would you do that and where you would do that? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, again, talking to your team after you listen to this episode of like, what would I do? What would the steps be? Because everything's different and your flow is different. So knowledge is power and talking it out is vital and so important. So gestational age, if they are coming in hot and heavy, if they are doing that wheelchair sign and there is like the wheelchair sign, they roll them back and they can't sit down. Like they're literally leaning to the side if they are.
And grunting.
Grunting. And they don't have to be using out of their minds because I don't like that like vocabulary to describe them. But I think we think like they have to be screaming or they have to just be so out of control, which again, I don't have vocabulary, but they can be so calm and collected and complete. Which is something to know.
But I think just remember, if they're complete and term, throw some gloves on, activate your team, move them to the room. And when the baby comes out, throw them on their skin, dry and stimulate. Nothing changes. Use whatever linens are right there. If they're skin to skin and crying, obviously, like if you need resuscitation, then keep the baby connected to the cord and roll them into a room. And you do your best.
And if they're eight, you might have time to like help the nurse getting the assignment. As a triage nurse, I know it's nice to be like, oh, I started their IV, I sent their labs, and like, we're trying to get an epidural. Those things will happen too. And I think gauging, you know, it's a prime at 7 or 8 centimeters, you could have time still to do an epidural. And so trying to get that for them could be really the top priority for the patient. If they're like, what do you mean? Especially if they're like eight, you're like, okay, we have time. And you know that your anesthesia team is fast and your lab is fast and just knowing your unit, giving realistic expectations for them.
Yep.
Okay, so the next one we want to talk about, vaginal bleeding. There's a lot that can be going on with vaginal bleeding. And a lot of people, they just, it's different. Like they consider bleeding spotting, and which is blood, but there's different types of bleeding and all our perception of bleeding is very different. And I think to give grace to patients, because for their whole pregnancy, bleeding has been very, very bad.
Yep.
And once they're term and maybe going into labor, sometimes we're like, ooh, blood, yay, cervical change. Or, oh, blood, that's not good. I think it's normal for them to come in for any kind of bleeding. So education is huge here. But yeah, let's talk vaginal bleeding.
I want to know gestational age and how much. Those are probably the two things off the top of my head that matter the most. If they're preterm, I'm going to go, different story. And if they're term with vaginal bleeding, then I'm like, how much? Because again, if it's spotting, I'm going, okay, I'm going to slow everything down. But if it's soaking pads, if it's dripping down their legs, if it's visible when they walk into triage, that patient needs one-on-one support and activated help, right? Yes. So once I know what's happening, and let's say it is profuse vaginal bleeding, right? Is the patient stable? Are they able to talk to me? Are they coherent? How long has it been happening? And I want to know their history. Yeah. Like get their vital signs going and ask them what history of pregnancies, previous C-section, scar on the uterus, where's your placenta? How long has this been happening? Because if it happened 30 minutes ago, that's different than 2 days ago. I've been having regular bleeding. How's their countenance? Are they pale? Are they yellow? How's their level of consciousness? Are they kind of out of it? All of those things are going to really make a difference. And really what you're doing is vaginal bleeding is a presenting symptom of many, many problems. So in your head, we need to know what are the problems that cause vaginal bleeding. And with that, then you're going, okay, let's say placenta previa. That's an easy one, right? Typically, they know if they have a placenta previa. They've been told their placenta is somewhere weird sometimes, or it's on the low part, or it's covering the cervix, or maybe they'll call it a previa, or yeah, they're hoping it would move. That kind of thing. If you rule in a placenta previa, you know the source of the bleeding. And obviously there could be something else going on, but that's going to be the highest chance. So ask about the placenta. No, my placenta has been normal. Cool. Cross it off in your head. That's what triaging is, right? Mm-hmm. You're sorting the patient. So then abruption / uterine rupture are the two other things that I would immediately go to. So what are our signs and symptoms of either one of those? What would you ask?
Have you had any trauma? Did you fall on your belly? Did you hit your belly? I mean, I think if they got in like a car accident, they'd probably be coming from the ED, but in that case, you'd be like thinking abruption.
Yep.
Do you have pain? What else could you ask?
Did it come on suddenly or has it been more gradual? If it's suddenly, I'd be more concerned of a rupture than I would if they have a history of a C-section or uterine scar. I'd be thinking potentially for rupture, uterine rupture. Mind you, again, that can happen anytime. But if they're not having contractions and they have a scar, I'd be more likely to think that. Obviously, in any case, I want to get the baby on the monitor at the same time while I'm getting vital signs. Hopefully, vital signs are good. If they're not, obviously, you're alerting teams and saying, hey, I have a hypotensive vaginal bleeding patient. I need all hands on deck. And in that case, I would prioritize an IV. And I'd get anesthesia in the room and I'd see what's happening with the baby. Because if there are signs with the baby, then obviously the perfusion has been affected enough that it's now affecting the placental blood flow. So with their history, and then, yeah, like if they've been in an MVA or they like, yeah, I fell down. And those, the trauma, I'd always think abruption. And remember, abruption is just when the placenta separates. Ideally, it's nice and stuck and all of the blood vessels are flowy from baby to parent. And if it starts to separate, there's a decreased blood flow to the baby. So likely you're going to see that on the fetal monitoring. So that assessment is going to be really important.
And you might not see it right away. I wanted to throw that there too. It can be a gradual onset. And so the typical observation for an abruption is 4 hours on minimum. I feel like most of the abruptions I see, it comes on suddenly. You're like irritated. You're like, they're fine. And then like 2 hours later, you're like, whoa, the baby's throwing variables. Contractions are starting to come. The pain is increasing. So just throwing that out there too.
Well, and you're having a provider in the room. If you have providers outside of the hospital, this is a call in for an assessment. This is a pull the ultrasound machine into the room, get it booted up for them so they can start to look on ultrasound what's going on. Because a lot of times if the abruption is big enough, they can see that on ultrasound and they'll know potentially. Now, what's interesting for me is a lot of my abruptions have delivered vaginally. So depending on where they're at in labor, are they having contractions? Are they not? Do they have acute pain or do they not? If a scar is opening with a rupture, they're likely going to feel pain at the incision site, meaning where
continuous
the scar is on.
Too.
Yes. And like a lot of times they're bracing their incision, they're holding, it feels like pulling, tugging, stretching, sharp. It happened. I felt this like pop. I've heard that once, et cetera, et cetera. So... once you see the vaginal bleeding, you've gotten all the info. You kind of have an idea what's going on. You've already alerted the team. Their vital signs are taken. The baby's on the monitor. And you've gotten an IV going for vaginal bleeding. By that time, I would expect you to have a whole bunch of people in the room. And you're passing off that patient and saying they are either moving directly to the operating room or they're moving to an LDR to figure out the rest of the clinical picture. And then you pass them off.
Yippee. Done.
Hopefully.
Chart
unless
away.
Their charge is like, no, I'm going to have you take them. You're like, really? This is the one?
All right. So that's that one. Easy peasy. You got it, guys. It's the practicing the like ruling out, like you said, figuring out where you are and what this is. And I think that can be anxiety inducing for newer nurses too. Like, I don't want to diagnose them. You're not diagnosing, you're just triaging mm-hmm. and you're giving ideas and you're making recommendations. I think it could be this. I think it could be that. And I think it's important for us to know those signs, know what it could be so that you can escalate the care too. So you can be like, no, it's this much blood. These are the vital signs. This is the baby. So then it does prompt the provider to come to the bedside, take you seriously because you are the eyes. And if you don't feel like you know that stuff, this is where it comes down to our professional responsibility to keep learning. Like, we got to know stuff. Mm-hmm. So we can't just rely on what we learned at the hospital or what we've learned from preceptors. You got to take classes.
For anyone who missed out on Cancun, listen up because I have some very exciting news. For literally one time only, we are offering a 2-day physiologic coping workshop as a live online event on February 29th and March 1st, 2024. The class lasts 9 hours total and we'll split it into 2 days for you to make it super digestible. And it includes everything that we taught in Cancun. So that's a $900 value for just $299 prior to January 15th. This is a crazy deal. We also offer amazing group discounts for groups of 10 or more. So reach out and save even more by getting in with your friends and coworkers. Besides earning you a whopping 9.4 CEs, you'll also learn everything you need to know about how to promote physiologic coping and physiologic birth and positively interact with the diverse demographic of birthing people, that's epiduralized and non-epiduralized patients, through non-pharmacological coping interventions that help contribute to a vaginal birth. You'll also know exactly how that's possible. And don't worry if you can't attend some or all of the live sessions because we're going to record it for you to view for up to 2 weeks following the event. This can't miss event took me 2 years of reading more than 300 resources. I traveled the world. I trained with some of the leading minds in physiology and childbirth and other random specialties. And I even became an intermediate MFR practitioner so that I could create and whittle all of that down to one single, easy to understand class that's applicable to your practice tomorrow. All of those who purchase tickets to the event will be entered for incredible prize giveaways that I will draw about each week leading up to the class, as well as a chance at an absolutely unprecedented grand prize that will seriously blow your minds. You will not want to miss it, and I will draw the winner at the class. This is the biggest prize we have ever given away, and you don't want to miss your chance by missing the class. You literally have nothing to lose. We would love to have you. Register now to get in on this amazing one-time opportunity using the link in the show notes below or on the bundlebirthnurses.com website.
And if you know those signs and symptoms, it's like, I can see the clinical presentation of an abruption. I can see the clinical presentation of a rupture. And again, sometimes they don't present exactly perfectly. Mm-hmm. And knowing those baseline emergencies that are the typical ones that we're going to see, of course, there's the one-offs. I love when you post those. What is this syndrome? There's so many things on Tracy right. Tuesdays. And I'm like, what? I've never heard of that before. So of course, there's other things going on, but you have to sort of look at the big picture and like the heavy hitters in OB to say, I know what to ask and I know what to assess. So that when the provider shows up, hopefully 5 seconds later, you can give that report and say, she's been having vaginal bleeding for the last hour. She's soaked 2 pads. There's no known previa, no history of C-section, you know, like sort of rattle off the list of things that you've already done, because that's going to expedite the patient's care rather than slow down. Hold on, let me ask all my questions again. In these emergencies, time is key and speed is everything. So the more you sort of just know what to ask, let me just like rattle it off. You're going to get that big picture and be able to activate whatever teams are necessary. Massive transfusion protocol, right? There's profuse vaginal bleeding. The patient is pale and barely able to talk to you. I need anesthesia in that room. I need double IVs. Of course, I need vital signs, whatever. And again, you're not doing any of this without a doctor's order, which is why you're calling and saying, I have an emergency in this room and can I start an IV? Of course, right? You get that verbal real quick. She needs an IV quick. You're alerting the other charge nurse. If they're pale and out of it, we're talking like possibly RRT here. Rapid response team. That came out funny. I was thinking RT, but rapid response. Like that might even be a rapid response in that case. You're thinking this patient could actually code on me if I'm not moving quickly. And I'd like to have an IV at least if they're going to try to die on me.
1,000%. I would like to.
Again, okay. Like, I feel like sometimes when we simplify these things, it's like, well, blah, blah, get them an IV, get that assessment, alert the team, and bye, or like respond to what comes. And I know it's not that simple. It's right. Very anxiety producing. You're shaking. And a lot of times when we have that adrenaline, our brains don't think quite as clearly, which is why you listen to episodes like this and you do your classes and you educate yourself so that it is sort of second knowledge rather than like, I didn't know what to ask. You can control that prior.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what to ask, you really are just like, I don't know what to ask. It's in your charting system. Look at what you have to ask when you do a regular triage. You'd be like, oh, I wouldn't even, that's why I have to ask that. And start critically thinking through that. Okay, the next one and last one we'll talk about today, hypertension. And I feel like this is like a pandemic of hypertensive patients all over our country right now. And I'm sure people listening are like, oh yeah, every patient you have. So they come in from the office, they had high blood pressures, they come in from home, they can come in different ways. So I feel like typical, you had a patient check in for high blood pressures and triage. So going back to that MIFTI episode, it's really a nice tool to use to be like, well, let me just take these people's blood pressures before even sending them back to know like, because you don't want someone sitting in the waiting room with 180 over 110, right? Mm-hmm. And so what is that person throwing in the waiting room?
Oh my gosh, what about a practice change? I'm like, especially in a demographic where you have a lot of triage patients, you have a high volume and you have one triage nurse and you have a lot of preeclamptic patients, you could have a CNA when they check them in, get them going, take their vital signs and report back.
Yeah.
I mean, so smart.
Yeah. I mean, that's why MIFTI exists because MIFTI, they literally just take their vital signs and send them back to the waiting room and like ask a couple questions.
But who's doing that?
A nurse. But the reason why is because you do Doppler tones. But yeah.
Yeah, but like what unit is actually doing that? Does your unit do that?
They do. I've never heard of that. They do that. But from what I've heard from DMs too, here's the thing that I'm thinking, and which isn't a good thing, but some units would say they don't want the liability of the high pressure and they don't have a nurse to take care of them.
Mm.
So.
That's fair.
That's what sucks.
I mean, fair from their perspective. Mm-hmm. It's too bad.
That's the reality of a lot of places. So number one is you got to know how to take a blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
We got to stop taking blood pressures laying on their left side. Quickly down to
or immediately when they get into the room.
Yeah.
I'm so-and-so. And you get the blood pressure cuff connected and like you talk to them and you have them just like settle in for a second. And then once they've sat, take their blood pressure. Now, mind you, if there's like an acute something going on, of course, take their blood pressure. But if they're coming in for, you know, my vision has changed or my doctor said my blood pressures were high, it really does only benefit them and you if you get an accurate blood pressure. Mm-hmm. But that initial get to a room, they're nervous, they're stressed, there's a new environment. Ah, how many times do you take a blood pressure and the first one is super high and mild range and you're like, dang it. And then you retake it and it's like 110 over 65.
Right.
And
you're like, oh, okay.
Exactly. Breathe for a second. It's going to be all right. And you're actually going to get an accurate blood pressure if you settle them in. And we're talking 2-3 minutes.
CMQCC recommends 5 minutes. Wait 5 minutes.
Perfect.
So there you go. Do all the strategies you learned from episode one of triage series and then take a blood pressure. Yeah. What happens? You get a high blood pressure. What are you going to do?
Depends on how high.
So it's 180 over 95.
I mean, I'm going to plan to repeat it because you do need a verification, but in anticipation of the fact that I'm going to have to push meds, I'm going to call somebody eventually once I get that second reading. But I'd probably pull all the IV supplies. Mm-hmm. I would get everything else ready. I'd help downregulate their nervous system. I would be anticipating it to still be high on the second read.
Yeah. And you can get all their history. How long has it been high? Do you have a family history? Have you had preeclampsia before? Headache, blurry vision, epigastric pain. With those signs, what we're looking for is end organ involvement. If they have preeclampsia, how severe has it gotten? And yeah, so 15 minutes, you take another one and it's high. The idea is you start the algorithm. That's the national recommendation. So do you have that in your hospital flow? Is that a standing order? You get two high pressures. Could you start an IV? And then as you're like starting an IV, calling the doctor and being like, hey, I have your patient, too severe. Do you want me to start the algorithm? depends on what you're going to do. It's not set, but some doctors like to start with hydralazine first. Some doctors like to start with labetalol first. You would want to start with hydralazine if your patient has a history of asthma instead of labetalol. Some units like to start with PO, nifedipine, right away. I actually had a one-on-one mentee, Jen, hi, if you're listening. They started a practice change because all of their night shift nurses were new and not very good at IVs yet. And so they did a practice change. They started nifedipine first because they were having a delay in trying to get these IVs started. And I was like, that's a great idea to just get something on board. So knowing when to give the med. So you give the med and then you wait 10 minutes and knowing like, do I go up in dosage, right? So labetalol, you're going to start with 20 and then go to 40. On nights, especially, and this is just in general with your hypertension patients, when do your doctors want you to call them back? Can you give them 20, 40, then 80, then call? Do you call them after 20? Do you call them after 40? Just knowing preferences because—
Well, your policies.
Yes, I'll say that. But then there's policy set in our place. Some, we have a lot of providers that don't even go with the algorithm. They're just like, this is what I want.
Well, then in that case, I'm going to push back about doing the right thing. You still need to call them. This is such a hard thing because yes, you're absolutely right. You get yelled at and abused and they're upset because why? And this is where for us, the ones getting yelled at, it's like, you have to realize that this is not you. You are doing the right thing and you are not responsible for their emotional response. If there's doctors listening, if there's hospital administrators listening, please internalize this. This is something that to me is like such a safety concern. Because if they're having severe range blood pressures and they're having to push meds, one, I just want a doctor at the bedside in general to help navigate this stuff. By the time you give the med, you repeat the thing, you got to pull another huge vial because you're at how many doses and they're still there. We need to be talking plan of care. We need to be talking C-section potentially. We need to be starting that. So again, what does your policy say? And when they push back, I am following the policy and procedure. It says to call you. What would you like me to do, doctor? Mm-hmm. And just keep it super objective. But ultimately, like if you're not following policies and you're doing it to their preferences, you end up potentially getting in trouble. And it's not the safest thing for the patient. There's a reason why we call a doctor, because we're not making the medical order. And we do, we have workflows and we have, you may have a policy that says you don't need a written order. You can get the verbal order, but I would still want the verbal order. What if you do tank them? And they said to, because they have their crazy protocol that like isn't actually following any algorithm. And now we're hypotensive and creating a mess.
Ephedrine is just a mess.
Right. Like it's, no, yeah, I hear you. But also, why do we have such a crisis in this country for safety, for families? Because of stuff like this. These
bad
are the barriers.
Emotional regulation.
Yes. And like lack of laziness. Mm-hmm. Call a spade a spade. I'm sorry, you got your medical degree and you are sleeping at home and I'm not. So do your job. And I will try not to call you if it's not necessary. But this is a case where it absolutely is necessary. And I am concerned. You know,
right.
Use your cuss.
I feel it's
anyway.
This is a safety issue.
Yeah, this is a safety issue. And I'm not willing to put the patient at risk by not waking you up.
Right.
You know, and again, I wouldn't necessarily say all of this, but know that we are behind you and for you for doing the right thing. It's about doing the right thing. And if there is a potential emergency, we can all think like, oh, it's fine. We'll give meds and it'll bring it down. It may not. The next step might be a stroke. Mm-hmm. So if you're having a stroke and you haven't called a doctor because you didn't want to wake them, you're in trouble now. And we don't want to scare you. And we always talk about, it's not about losing your license. It's not about getting in trouble. But in that case, what was the right thing? We also still have to practice safely. So my soapbox, I'm stepping down. But again, it's like all of this comes back to my frustration with looking at the medical system of like, what aren't we doing? We're not prioritizing safety or the patient. We're prioritizing our own comfort. That's why we're not at the bedside all the time. We want to hang out at the nurse's
station. Well, I feel like, so there might be a protocol that says do the 20, 40, and 80. Just do it.
Then if that's the case, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. All I'm advocating for is following your policies and procedures. Yeah. And if you get pushback by the doctor, keep following your policies and procedures.
If you have them, because you didn't even have them.
Yeah, but we had protocols. It was in the order set. So we could push without the doctor, but we also had residents. So if I was in triage, I'd be like, hey, resident. And the residents always wanted to be involved anyway, because it was always like, ooh, learning opportunity.
Yeah.
So it was different. Anyway.
Okay. So you start the algorithm and you have to figure out. So then again, you want to know gestational age, G's and P's. How are they going to deliver? Are they a 39 and 2 repeat C-section? Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's just, you can anticipate this baby's going to be another C-section tonight. Right. So knowing how they're going to deliver, are they a prime and they could be induced? Is MAG going to be started and should be started? Are they preterm and they need to start antibiotics? Even if they're like 33 and 6 and they're going to do a C-section in the morning and they won't get a second dose of beta, it's actually, the evidence shows one dose is better than none. And so being like mindful of steroids for the baby, remembering baby in this case. This one's a little more tricky too, because you're trying to protect mom, but then you're like, oh, baby, I also need to put baby in there. And it is a little bit more complicated of the different systems that are in place about their organs. And you're thinking about seizure, but like you just said, ultimately you're thinking about stroke. So going back to seizure, do you know what to do if there is a seizure that happens if the preeclampsia does become eclampsia? We had recently an observation patient that came in for preterm labor and all of a sudden just started seizing, and she didn't have any history of preeclampsia. Just all of a sudden went to eclampsia. It was out of nowhere. Everything worked well and she was fine and baby delivered pretty quickly after. But it's because everyone knew what to do. They were like, okay, let's get labs. Let's call this team. Let's get push the meds. I feel like when you have a demographic that has a lot of hypertension, there's a lot of knowledge. You can pull from a lot of different people of like, what do we do? And how do we do it? And this one is literally just learning. So many people, including CMQCC, have created hundreds and hundreds of pages of algorithms and packages.
Yes.
It's all over your unit. Look for it and you'll find it of like what to do. The same with hemorrhage. We're not going to go over that with this one, but hemorrhage is the same. There's so many different people that have put a lot of work into this. And to plug mentorship, we have a lot of hypertension stuff in mentorship and we can make you feel real good about it in our some scary stuff module. So yeah, I think this one, knowing information is power here.
Speaking of mentorship, one of the things I remember emphasizing, I can't remember which of the many classes that's in there, but was talking about safety checks. So along those lines, it's sort of like what's in your triage rooms. That obviously goes for your labor rooms as well. But when you're specifically thinking triage, and especially when you're turning around these rooms so quickly and housekeeping's coming in and they're zhuzhing the room and they come back in, like what are your safety supplies? Do you know where your Ambu bag is? Do you have suction tubing and a yanker close by? Yonker. Some people call it a yonker. What do you call it?
A yonker.
Oh, I call it a yanker.
You call things weird. You call stevia stevia. So
yeah, it's stevia. It's not stevia. Stevia. I think of a man. It's stevia. Anyway, do you have a yonker and suction tubing? Where is your blood pressure cuff? Where's your oxygen tubing, oxygen mask? And then where are your IV supplies? Many units, sometimes you can just like grab the stuff. It's right there. But like, do you have a little kit that you can just grab? And I would always make those at the beginning of triage to have all of the supplies. Crash cart. Where's your crash cart? How far is it away? What's the quickest route to out the door? Is there trash cans in the way? Maybe you reorient your room and your trash cans at the end of the bed instead of blocking the exit. And that goes with cleanliness of the room, et cetera. So I think knowing that you have all of your supplies, eyeball the room before you put a patient in it. And I think it's easy to sort of get jaded when you triage 6,000 patients all the time, and most of them are rule out labor, that you will eventually get that one where you are needing those emergency supplies. And if you're like, oh shoot, where's the Ambu bag? Like, I'll never forget, I had an AFE and we like could not, people were like scrambling to find the Ambu bag, and anesthesia shows up, they grabbed it, and all of a sudden we were bagging the patient. But that's way too much stress.
Yeah.
Just eyeball it and go, yep, I know I'm good. And in your head, you've made that mental note. I know I'm good. And now I know that I have what I need in the case of an emergency.
It's such a good point. And I think too, ultimately, I was thinking about these emergencies. It's like they're going to deliver most of the time in these big emergencies. So what route will they take to deliver? And sometimes it will be a C-section. So I was like, you need to know how to prep a C-section. Because you're going to, you know, you're going to get them ready and get them back.
Yeah.
And get them ready to deliver vaginally and whatever that means for them. And then educating them along the way and telling them they're in good hands.
Don't forget them.
Yeah, don't forget them. Telling them they're in good hands, especially with the hypertensive patients. I think there's a lot of anxiety that comes with like all of a sudden you had high pressures. Now you're going to get induced for these high pressures. And something I like to say, I've said recently, and I don't even know if it's a good way to say it, but we have a lot of patients in our community that have preeclampsia and hypertension. And so we really know how to take care of you. Like, it's going to be okay. You're in really good hands, because we do, myself included.
So. Yeah. But that might be a connecting point. Look, I had preeclampsia when I had my baby. This is not uncommon. Obviously, we're concerned, but we know exactly what to do to help fix it. And we'll cross that. We'll cross each bridge as we get there. We're here for you. I love that.
Yeah. So yeah, that's our triage number 3 episode.
Yay. We did it.
You're welcome. I hope it was helpful. And I hope that you were inspired to kind of look at your systems, especially if you're going to be doing triage soon. Mm. When you're starting to train in triage, what is the system and who do we call? And exactly, like, do your safety checks and your routes to get out of the room and all of that pre-work would be so helpful.
Knowing about everything. It's like back to that education piece of like, understand what might show up. You're not diagnosing, you're assessing. That's the key here of like, what questions do I ask? What do I check for to help piece the clinical picture together for the provider to ultimately make a diagnosis? But you want to assist in that process and you need to know when to alert the team.
And if you've been doing triage for a while and you're going to work tonight and you're like, I'm going to do it different, just blame it on this episode. Be like, listen, I listened to a podcast episode. I'm re-inspired. I'm going to do it different. Your triage buddy's like, what are you doing? Like, are you doing safety checks? Because it's the right thing to do. And let's keep our anxiety down. Because I think too, we're all scared at the, we don't want something bad to happen. We want to keep everyone safe. And so there's always this little level of adrenaline and scaredness, I feel like, in triage. You just never know what's going to walk in the door. I think it keeps us alert.
Yep. So channel that energy to for good. And I think too, it's sort of like what I teach patients is control what you can control and then let go of the rest. And what you can control is your education going into it, having the knowledge, knowing where things are, doing your safety checks. Why are you laughing? She's laughing.
Because I was thinking about my colleague at work and she, you know, those round balls on the ceiling that help you like see things, people coming in, like the mirrors.
Yeah.
It's like 2 o'clock in the morning and she sees the door open of triage. No one had called her to say someone was coming back. And it's like a big group of people, like a lot of people. And her first thought was like, am I getting a Daisy Award? What happened was it was a real emergency, like coming from the ED. Like there was just lot of people.
That is such a Debbie Downer.
You never know what's coming.
It yeah. It might be a Daisy Award someday, but it probably more likely is an emergency. No, it's great. Prepare yourself for a Daisy Award or for the herd of ED people freaking out coming at a pregnant person.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
I think ultimately, just remember that when you're in triage, it's your job to assess and sort them out. Figure out where they're going, alert the team. Obviously, we've heard the same themes over and over again, but I hope you see that as like, oh, it's not that complicated. You need to know how to start an IV. You need to know what to look for. And remember that first impression is everything. If you haven't listened to Vanessa's episode on first impressions, oh my gosh, talk about gold. We're going to use it in our mentor meeting this week. We have coming up with our mentors for like that initial impression can really help not only their nervous system, not only their experience, but also it can help you feel connected and actually get the information that you need to be able to triage better. Hone in on those skills and then pass them off. Send them on their merry little way and then see what's next. And that's the adventure of it all.
Thanks for spending your time with us during this episode of Happy Hour with Bundled Birth Nurses. If you like what you heard, it helps us both if you subscribe, rate, leave a raving review, and share this episode with a friend. If you want more from us, head to bundledbirthnurses.com or follow us on Instagram.
Now it's your turn to go and do your safety checks. Whether you're in triage or not, anticipate those emergencies, have all of the steps in your brain of what questions you're going to ask, and make sure you've set them up for safety. We'll see you next time.